Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I should say welcome back to our number two, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about money in the elections of 2008, and also try to talk a little bit about what has been happening in recent years as people have tried to reform the campaign finance system that we have here in this country. Last month, Barack Obama said that he would decline public financing for the 2008 general election campaign. That means that in his run for the presidency, there would be no limits on the amount of money that he can raise and spend. Supporters of campaign finance were disappointed by this decision, saying essentially that his action meant the end of the presidential public financing system. We'll take up that and other questions this morning in this part of Focus 580 as we talk with Thomas Mann. He is the Averill Harriman Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He was, between 1987 and 1999, Director of Governmental Studies at Brookings. Before that, he was Executive Director of the American Political Science Association, and he has taught at a number of universities, among them Princeton, Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, the University of Virginia, and American University. He's done a lot of different things. He's done polling for congressional candidates. He's worked as a consultant to the Public Broadcasting Service. He chaired the board of overseas of the National Election Studies. He also served as an expert witness in the constitutional defense of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law and does a lot of speaking around the country and, in fact, outside of the U.S. on American politics and public policy. And we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us this morning from Brookings in Washington. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. As always, we do ask one thing, though, that when people call in, they just try to be brief in their comments so we can keep moving and get as many callers in as possible. But certainly, folks who are listening are welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call. And Dr. Mann, hello.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Happy to be with you.
This is an issue that I know that you have followed and thought about and written about for some time now. Let me just ask you, I'm interested in your reaction to the reaction to Senator Obama's, his campaign's decision to opt out of public financing in the general election here. Does that really mean the end of the presidential public financing system?
The public financing system is really divided into two parts. The first applies to candidates for their party's nomination. It's a matching grant system with spending limits attached to it. Then the second part is a grant of public funds in the general election that's supposed to be full financing of that general election campaign. The first part has been dead for some time, effectively. In 2000, George Bush opted out of that system and was the first successful candidate for the presidency to do so. He was followed in 2004 by Howard Dean and John Kerry. And then this cycle, in 2008, all of the major candidates for the presidency in both parties except John Edwards, decided to opt out because they found the spending limits associated with those public matching funds way too low. So it's until that system is modernized, it's effectively dead. The controversy now has to do with the general election because John McCain, who did eventually opt out of the public financing system for the nomination phase, has indicated he would accept the public grant of $84 million for the general election. And Barack Obama, a longtime supporter of public financing, has indicated that he would not. He would opt out and therefore be in a position to raise and spend directly all the money that he wants. Whether or not this presages a a complete collapse of the entire program. The second, as well as the first, I suppose, depends upon what happens this time and whether the program is revised in any way to make it more appealing to candidates in subsequent years.
If one had decided that you were going to do this, say you were running for president, you said, okay, I will take this money in this grant to use in the general election, how much money would you get?
It's $84 million, I think $84.1 million that you would get from the from the government, the public finance program, for the roughly two-month general election campaign. In addition to that, you would be able to help raise and spend in coordination with your political party another roughly $15 million. Then, in addition to that, the party could raise and spend all its money that it could, as long as it was done independently of the presidential candidate and his campaign. So the point is, John McCain will have $84 million public grant, roughly $15 million that he can spend of party money in close coordination with the party, and then what many expect to be have spent another maybe $200 or more million raised and spent by the Republican National Committee independently of his campaign. Mm-hmm. So there's no effective limit possible under Supreme Court's rulings that parties have a constitutional right to raise and spend as much money as they want on behalf of their candidate, as long as it is done independently of that candidate.
So when you look at that, you add that up, that's a significant amount of money. However, if you take a look at the amounts of money that these candidates raised when they were competing for the nomination, and you have the expectation that they would continue to raise significant amounts of money, and so far it looks as if the Obama campaign has continued to raise a lot of money, you would see why it was a candidate perhaps might want to forego this money, because he or she would know that they going out on their own could raise a whole lot more money than that. It's simply a matter of taking a look at the dollar amounts, and probably anybody would make that decision. Yeah, I'll pass up the $84 million, because if I can raise $300 million on my own, you know, why should I limit myself to that $84 million plus whatever else the party can kick in?
Well, I think that's right. Obama clearly is raising amounts of money sufficiently high now that he can be expected to be able to raise now enough to both spend fully before his convention during the so-called primary season, as well as to raise and spend enough to perhaps double or triple the amount that would come from the public grant. But here's the critical point. It's less about the total amount of money that can be raised and spent than it is about how that money can be spent. I mean, Obama could have taken the $84 million and then proceeded over these next months to raise, let's say, $300 million and transfer it to the Democratic National Committee before he was formally nominated in Denver, at which point the Democratic National Committee could have turned around and spent that $300 million on behalf of Obama's campaign, but it would have to do so independently of it. Obama's campaign chiefs could not steer the expenditure of those funds. What Obama decided was he didn't want to lose control of the spending for his campaign. And the only way to avoid losing control once he were to spend over the $84 million public grant plus the $15 million in coordinated party spending, that would be lost beyond that, the direct control. So the only way to be able to spend all of the dollars he anticipated being raised and spent was to forego the public funds, to raise the money, and to control it himself, to be able to spend all of those dollars himself and not hope that someone at the DNC will run the right kind of ads or allocate the funds to the states that are priority places and ads for his own campaign. So the bottom line here is, and there's been a lot of public confusion about this, Obama's decision does not affect the overall amount of money to be spent on his campaign in any significant way. It affects who controls the expenditure of those funds.
Hmm. So if you're then interested in the problem, or if you see money in politics as a problem, or the total amount of money spent as a problem, or where the money comes from, then it sounds as if it wouldn't make any sense to argue, well, the problem here is the cap. And so if we just lift the cap on that $84 million, then we would have candidates saying, well, okay, now that you've raised the amount of money that I can raise and spend, I'll go ahead and I'll take that money. It seems that the whole thing, that maybe the intent back in the 70s when all this was set in place was to try to place some limits on spending, but it seems as if, in fact, it hasn't done that. I'm not sure if it ever did.
Well, that's right. Constitutionally, it wasn't clear back when the program was set up that in fact parties could spend independently of their candidates within the framework of a public finance system with overall spending limits. But since that time, the court has made it absolutely clear they have that right, and therefore the efforts to try to control spending in the general election have failed on constitutional grounds. In the primary phase, the nomination phase, there the spending limits have been so low that all serious candidates have decided that it would handcuff them to accept the public matching funds. Now some reformers would like to modernize that system by raising the spending limits, but say they double them in the primary process from roughly 50 to 100 or triple them to 150, that's still not going to be appealing, say, to an Obama who's already raised $326 million dollars for the primary process and will undoubtedly raise, another $100,000. So I really believe that what is threatened right now by both the constitutional and the practical realities of candidates being able to raise money and being required to start their general election campaign in earnest very early in the process is that the spending limits just don't work. And it seems to me until we back away from the idea of spending controls and maybe view public financing more as seed money rather than as a lever for controlling spending, we're not going to get the candidates to participate.
Mm. You know, having said what I said about some people maybe feeling frustrated that this never quite worked very well, I guess I do wonder how it is, though, that at least from the mid-70s when this was put into place until 2000, people who were running for president and they were running for their party's nomination did indeed accept the financing and accepted that limit. And as you said, it was not until 2000 when George Bush was the first person to opt out of the matching funds for the nominating season. And then the next time around in 2004, both Howard Dean and John Kerry did. But why was it that, say, between 1974 and 2004, it held?
It worked quite well then. It seems to me the amounts early on were still pretty realistic. That is, the overall level of spending seemed consistent with what the candidates had to do. And the fact is, fundraising was hard. With the limits in place, say limiting the size of individual contributions, and with there not being much success in sort of really small donor fundraising by individual candidates. So all in all, it made sense in the primary process and in the general election. What you started seeing, first of all, early on, the amount seemed sufficient, but gradually the parties and the candidates started maneuvering to supplement those dollars. They broke out big time in 1996 with the Clinton campaign when they made an argument that the parties could run so-called issue ads that were related to the campaign but didn't explicitly call for the election or defeat of a particular candidate, and financed those ads in large part with so-called soft money, unregulated dollars coming from corporations, unions, and large individual contributions. So starting in 96, you saw substantial additional expenditures made on behalf of the presidential candidates. The Republicans followed suit in 96, and then in 2000, there were large soft money expenditures on both sides of the contest. Then the McCain-Feingold law was passed in 2002, eliminating that soft money, which seemingly took away from the ability of parties to supplement, but parties found that they could raise a lot of hard money contributions, and then the court clarified that candidates could accept the public grant in the general election and still have their parties spend independently of them. That's how the system has evolved over time.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Thomas Mann. He's the W. Averill Harriman Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Also has served as Director of Governmental Studies at Brookings. Before that, he was Executive Director of the American Political Science Association. He has taught a number of places, Princeton, Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, University of Virginia, American University. And we're talking here about campaign finance. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could talk just a little bit about the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, more popularly known as McCain-Feingold, after the two guys who were the chief sponsors. It was intended to deal with issues like soft money, and I think that a lot of people were hopeful that perhaps it might change the political money landscape a little bit. What do you think has been the practical outcome of McCain-Feingold and whether, in fact, it changed things much at all?
Well, some people had expectations for that law that went well beyond the design of the law itself. That is, some imagined it would reduce the amount of money spent or at least slow the rate of increase, although that wasn't written into the law in any way. The idea was first and foremost to eliminate party soft money, that is, to take party officials and elected officials out of a position in which they could seek unlimited amounts of money from corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals. The corporate and union contributions had been banned in federal elections decades earlier, but this was a loophole in which ostensibly they were giving for a purpose other than federal election campaigns, but in effect, their dollars were used for precisely that purpose, so-called issue ads or sham issue ads. So what I would say is that we now look back on that law and find that in its foremost objective, it's been completely successful. Parties are out of the soft money raising business. Those dollars cannot be accepted or solicited by the parties and by presidents and members of Congress. There are hard money limits on what the parties can receive, but parties are adaptable, and frankly, I'm a strong supporter of political parties, and I predicted that they would compensate for the soft money with more vigorous efforts to raise smaller contributions, and they've succeeded in doing precisely that. So you don't have a reduction in the amount of money, but certainly you've eliminated this area of sort of potential conflict of interest and, frankly, extortion by having these unlimited amounts capable of being raised from unlimited sources. So that's the first thing. The second was to keep corporations and unions from avoiding the prohibition on using their treasury funds in federal elections by running and financing so-called issue advertising that was directly related to the campaign. It came up with a new class of communication called electioneering communication. It was broadcast communication focused on a particular electoral constituency and occurring either 30 days before a primary election or 60 days before a general election. For the most part, that provision worked as well, although the Supreme Court recently reached a decision that opens the possibility of a so-called as-applied challenges to the law that over time may render it ineffective. But for the most part, it's worked now. It's just that all these other aspects of the campaign finance system have gone forward, some of which, let me say, are exceedingly encouraging. This time, of course, it's been the rise of small donors. Obama has now raised over half of his funds from contributions of less than $200. In June of this year, he raised 65% of his contributions, which in, for the primaries were about $47-48 million. Of that, $31 million came in these small contributions and mainly over the internet. That's a huge change in the financing of our elections. Obama through June, from the beginning of 2007 to through June of this year, had raised over $165 million in contributions of $200 or less. That's putting new money into the system. It's healthy new money. That money is being spent not just on television ads, but in Obama's case, increasingly on building local organizations in most of the states and expanding the field of competition and participation. The parties are doing the same things. Both of them have substantial small donor programs. It's beginning to spread to the congressional party campaign committees as well. So this is a really positive development that is, frankly, perfectly consistent with the McCain-Feingold legislation.
Let's talk with a caller. We have someone in Champaign listening to us here. We'd like to join in. Line number one.
Yeah, my question on state and federal campaigning, if they raise political campaigns for themselves and not use it and have excess, are they able to use that at retirement or when they're out of office in the later years? Is that what I understand correctly on contributions at, you know, when they retire out of office, they can use it for their personal use?
That was once the case, but some years ago, the law was changed to prohibit the personal use of leftover campaign funds. What federal office holders can do with those dollars is, number one, transfer it to their political party for use in other campaigns. Secondly, contribute it to a charity. Or thirdly, sort of convert it into some other political committee that they can spend at some subsequent point if they choose to run for another federal office.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I guess that as far as state people who are running for state office, I'm sure that differs from state to state. But I think that change has also a lot of states have made that change as well. So if you run for governor, you can't retire and spend your leftover campaign money on go out and buy a car or buy a house.
That's right. There is a good deal of variation across the states regarding campaign finance regulation. I mean, some states like Virginia and to some extent Illinois have very modest regulations regarding contributions. But many states now have provisions preventing state officials from spending leftover funds for their own personal use.
Next caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, you say this, all these small contributions are a good thing, but I guess one might think they'd be good would they reduce the clout of the lobbyists, but I mean, you think that, like, for instance, the telecommunications industry has any less clout than it did before? In fact, it seems like it's become much, much stronger.
Well, the clout of an industry or a particular corporate entity depends on many factors, on the number of employees it has and where they are based, on the size and effectiveness of their lobbying staff. It certainly doesn't simply flow from their political contributions. There are many members of Congress who would fight to defend the rights of particular industries that have major facilities in their congressional district if they didn't get a penny of campaign contributions from them. So you can't expect that simply diversifying the funds that are available to candidates will in and of itself reduce the influence of other private sector players in the process in some direct proportional way. But I do think over time the system would be healthier. There would be sort of less potential for the direct influence of political contributions on public policy decisions if millions and millions and millions of citizens in this country made small contributions and politicians felt they had not just presidential candidates, but those for the House and Senate and governor and state legislature felt they had the potential to raise dollars from this more diversified base. I do think it would, over time, have a healthy impact on the process.
Hmm. Just to make clear, there are limits on the amount of money that you can give to a candidate. You can give a certain amount of money during a primary. You can give a certain amount of money during the general election. So as an individual, there's a limit to how much I could give to a particular candidate. Are there, if I wanted to, say, give money to one of the parties, are there limits on how much money I could give to the party?
Yes. The limits to individual federal candidates are $2,300 in a primary, $2,300 in a general election. For a political party, one can give a substantially higher amount to the federal, to a national political party committee or a group of them, one can give over a two-year cycle up to $28,000. And one can also give small amounts to some state parties. The total amount that any individual can give in an election cycle is about $100,000. So yes, the contribution limits to political parties are substantially higher than to individual candidates.
Yeah. And it may be just worth noting here that in the state of Illinois, there is no limit on how much money you can give to a candidate, and it's been that way for a long time. I'm not sure whether people realize that. I think the argument has been made all along that transparency is the thing that balances that. I'm not sure how well that works, but that is the situation here. And I'm not sure in how many other states it is the case that there are no limits on campaign contributions for someone running for state office.
Yeah, there are very few. As you saw, the two examples I plucked up were Virginia and Illinois, which are known for the absence of any limits on the size of contributions to candidates for state office.
Mm-hmm. And so it is true that there are interests that can give large amounts of money. I suppose the way that what you do is that you get together a whole bunch of individual contributors and you get all of those individuals to contribute the maximum amount. You have enough of those, then you can put together a significant amount of money and give one of the parties or a candidate a very large chunk of money. And at the same time, what you're still doing is you're abiding by the limits because technically you're saying, well, this has come in small contributions from 100 people or 1,000 people or 5,000, however many people you have, you can do it that way. And people who can manage to put that much money together, you figure that they've got to have at least some kind of influence or at least they'll get some access by giving that kind of money.
But most companies, corporations, choose another option, which is to form a political action committee, so-called PAC, that are voluntary in the sense that individuals working for managers of that company make voluntary contributions to the PAC. The PAC can then contribute to federal candidates. But then here, too, there's a limit of $5,000 of what can be given by any one PAC to a candidate in the primary and $5,000 in a general election. But as you suggest, in addition, say, executives of a company can cut their own personal checks. Where you see the, if you will, the bundling of individual contributions tends to be other kind of organizations. Emily's list, early money is like yeast, is where Emily comes from. It's a group that tries to encourage and support the election of women to public office, and their process is to have a large number of members and then tell those members that they should contribute to the candidates on their list, and they facilitate their that process. Of course, we also see it in presidential fundraising where all of the presidential candidates identify individuals who are willing to ask other individuals to contribute, and we now have elaborate structures of bundlers and ways of identifying individual contributions with the person who helped arrange them. That's all part of the process.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Thomas Mann. He is the Harriman Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, has been at Brookings for some time. He was Director of Governmental Studies there. Before that, he was Executive Director of the American Political Science Association. And we're talking here about campaign finance. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, can't we just, it seems like in Illinois, can't we call it what it is? It seems like just a legalized payoff, and they raise these large sums of money for favoritisms, or in our state we've got jobs given to large sums of money giving by one or two donors, and they get favorite concessions in the state. Isn't that just what it is, a legalized payoff in this sense?
That's a perfectly plausible formulation of it. Many states have had effective pay-to-play systems. That is where the expectation is that any companies who want to compete for state contracts better pony up to the officials in charge, contribute to their campaign coffers or to the party in charge. We've now had a number of states actually move to adopt legislation to prohibit any companies with contracts with the state from making such contributions, but Illinois stands apart from that movement.
Well, I think we should say that in fairness to the General Assembly, maybe we shouldn't want to be fair to the General Assembly, that a pay-to-play bill has actually passed. And I think it was nearly unanimous. It passed the General Assembly, has gone on to the governor. And the governor's comment so far has been, well, he thinks that's good, but it could be improved. So he hasn't said yet what he would do with it. Would he try to make changes? Would he sign it? And I think that there are some people who sort of take the jaundiced view that if this just gets dragged out, this nothing's going to happen at all. But at least there, I think that there are people in Springfield who do think that that's important, mm-hmm. and have made some moves in that direction. So I guess we'll sort of see how that plays out.
Well, that's a very encouraging development.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I thank the caller. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Do you think that it seems that people who are concerned with campaign finance or interested in trying to place some sort of limits on how much money is given and how much money is spent, what they're coming up against is a fairly consistent over some time now interpretation by the U.S. Supreme Court that people have a right and that it's related to their right to free speech, the right to give money to candidates, that people, individuals, have the right to spend as much of their own money as they want. Although apparently the court has been okay with the idea that there are caps placed on how much people can give. I guess I've never been quite sure how that squares with the idea that money is speech, but at any rate, there's this overall idea that you want to, I guess, have as few limits as possible. How much of a barrier is that, do you think, toward to serious reform?
It's a huge barrier. Now, you may say it's good we have that barrier. You know, people differed intensely on this point. Some believe that an entirely deregulated, unregulated system is the only one that preserves the free speech rights guaranteed under the Constitution. The courts, however, and the Supreme Court in particular, has at various times allowed for various forms of regulation, just as they have on other forms of free speech. You can't scream fire in a movie theater. The Buckley Court, the critical decisions made back in 1976, threw out mandatory spending limits for candidates, and they also threw out any limit on what individuals can spend on behalf of their own campaigns. But they did find there was a reasonable grounds, compelling interest in preventing corruption or the appearance of corruption via limits on the size of contributions that are made to candidates and to political parties. So that part of the law has held up, as has requirements regarding transparency and various voluntary programs of public funding with various restrictions attached to those. However, we have seen in the last couple of years, with the changing composition of the Supreme Court, a reversal of sorts. And I think if the ideological complexion of this court remains the same and potentially moves further in that direction, then it's not inconceivable that the Buckley decision upholding contribution limits could be repealed, and we really could return to a state of nature in our financing. That means the only route to putting limits on would be via a constitutional amendment.
Mm. Really? So you think it is possible that some future court, maybe not in the distant future, but in the near future, might look again at the caps on individual contributions and say, well, wait a minute, how do we justify that, particularly given if we say that individuals can spend as much of their own money, and if we have this sort of key idea that that's up to you, it's your expression of support for a candidate. So how do we say that there should be any limits at all? You think it's possible some court might say, well, no, there should not be any limits?
I think it is possible. The last three decisions of the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Roberts have moved in a restrictive direction, and their language has been such as to, while taking modest incremental steps, to invite larger challenges to the structure of campaign finance. They haven't been reluctant to reverse decisions made only a few years ago. So I think it's uncertain territory, I would not be surprised to see movements in that direction. It's one of the reasons why I, as someone who've been involved in campaign finance reform, and certainly that was true with respect to the passage and the constitutional defense of the McCain-Feingold law, I supported those moves, but I see increasing limits on what one can do in light of court interpretations of constitutional restrictions, and I'm searching for new ways, perhaps occasioned by the rise of the internet, not just for fundraising but for campaigning, to begin to find alternatives to regulations that we've used in the past but may not be possible in the future.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people have argued, and we unfortunately have just a couple of minutes left here, but a lot of people have argued that if you're interested in campaign finance reform, the place you have to start is on the state level. And by constructing a kind of a system that would allows public financing for the campaigns, and that then in exchange for that financing that candidates voluntarily agree to limit spending. And there have been some places that they have tried to do that. Have any of them, do you think, have been particularly successful?
Well, they've had some success. The Arizona system has worked to some extent, as has the Maine system. But we've now had the defeat of full public financing system in several other states. Some municipal governments have tried to move in that direction. But let me tell you, there's something really worrisome here as well, because most of these laws have provisions that say that if one candidate in a general election accepts the full public financing, but the other does not, then the limits on the one who that took the public financing, the limits on spending are off or are raised significantly. The court, in rejecting a provision of McCain-Feingold, the so-called Millionaires Amendment, basically said that laws that treat candidates unequally are not constitutional. So they may have set the conditions for eliminating one major feature of the full public financing models that have gone forward to the state. So those systems are potentially threatened as well.
See, we get one more caller in here. Someone calling from Spring Bay. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
If you've covered this, I apologize. I came in late. But how effective do you think McCain-Feingold has been? And secondly, the day that was put through the House, there was an alternative offered in the House, which was voted down. My local congressman voted against McCain-Feingold and voted for the alternative. Would that have been any more effective, in your opinion, than McCain-Feingold? Now get off, and this is your answer.
Right.
Thank you.
The alternative that was considered was really a bill to effectively eliminate any controls on party soft money at all. It set up a system whereby you could do the same thing in the 50 states and then combine it all and give it to the federal candidates. So it wasn't a serious alternative, as I did discuss earlier. McCain-Feingold had limited objectives and has largely succeeded in realizing those objectives, the most important being the elimination of party soft money in federal elections. But that other features of the system have now come to dominate, and some of which are encouraging, like the rise of small donors, but others are certainly more problematic, including some of the outside independent groups that manage to avoid the restrictions on the source and size of contributions, but nonetheless engage in campaign activities.
So it presents us real quick here at the end with a kind of a mixed picture. On the one hand, that you might say, for example, the fact that we do see in this year's campaign a growing number of contributions from individuals, Americans, small contributions, as you said, less than for Obama, for example, a lot of people gave less than $200. One might see that to be encouraging, and yet still the staggering amounts of money that are raised and spent, and the inclination of the court to be hands-off, that I'm not sure whether there overall there is reason to be encouraged if you're concerned about this.
Well, if you're concerned about the overall amount, then you have plenty of reasons to retain that level of concern. But I want to suggest that, in my mind, that's never been the problem. We're a huge country. Most Americans do not naturally pay a lot of attention to politics and public affairs. We have massive, massive advertising budgets for commercial products. It's hard to get the attention of potential voters with campaigns by individuals or political parties. It frankly takes a lot of money. And what we are seeing this time in both parties are huge amounts of money being raised, but much of that being spent to really engage individuals at the local level. I think that's good. I think the problematics are when the amounts they're raised, the funds are raised in amounts that introduce sort of conflicts of interest and give certain individuals an interest advantage over others. It's problematic when all of the money goes to, say, incumbents and none to challengers, or all to one party and little to the other, when you get imbalances in that fashion. But I think as citizens, we ought to remove the focus on the amount of money, because that's not the issue. In many respects, it's a trifle compared to economic activity in the country and other expenditures. Let's try to get more Americans giving smaller amounts. Let's try to make it available to challengers as well as incumbents. Let's diversify the pool. Let's try to lower the cost of campaigning by creative uses of the internet. There are many things that we can do that won't affect the overall amounts, but will have very positive effects on our politics.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. Dr. Thomas Mann is the Averill Harriman Chair and Senior Fellow in Government Studies at the Brookings Institution of Washington. Dr. Mann, thank you very much.
Happy to be with you.
And thanks to the folks there in the other end of the connection there at Brookings in Washington.